And we're back. Back in the room for another episode of Scots Radio, and a programme that celebrates the Scots language and culture. And as is just the wild, we're nae hinging aboot again. Let me introduce our soon sorter, for sorts are the fichery bits in the wheelhouse, Richie Weather.
Hey, how we doing, buddy?
Oh, right? I think I'm just doing fine, aye?
Bro.
Right, in this programme, we're in among the heavy horses, Richie.
Is that right?
Heavy horses at the Heelan Show. You like the heavy horses, do you? And we're going to give you a wee preview for this year's event. And we're hearing mair aboot Oxter Pipes in the northeast of Scotland. And we mull over the media and the new demands on opportunities at the Celtic Media Festival on the Isle of Man. But afore all that, here's a track for a CD I picked up when I was there for a group called Thynodery. I'm not going to try the Manx language and the titles of the tunes, but I'll just say this is a selection of Manx tunes. That was Thynodery, with a selection of Manx tunes for the Isle of Man. And that's where we start at the recent Celtic Media Festival, held this year at Douglas on the Isle of Man. Scots Radio had the honour of being nominated for an award at the festival this year, and our category was ably won by BBC Wales. Congratulations to that team. But the awards are just part of the festival. This is an annual opportunity for all the Celtic nations that support their indigenous or minority languages to get together to fanoot fits happening in their part of the park. I joined the delegates to hear the keynote address for the Director General of RTE, Dee Forbes. RTE is the public service broadcaster based in Dublin. The speech was a cracker of a speech that addressed all the new demands for a changing media environment and the relevance of programme content. Phew, that was a biggie. Well, I was sitting next to Maggie Cunningham, listening to the keynote address. Maggie is chair of MG ALBA, far runs BBC ALBA, in partnership with the BBC. Before I got Maggie's tack on what Dee Forbes had said, I asked her about the relevance of the Celtic Media Festival.
Well, I think Dee Forbes tried to analyse it very well. I mean, the reality of all the Celtic nations is that we are on the periphery of Europe, whether it's periphery of France, in Britain, in Wales, in Spain, in Galicia, and in Ireland, obviously, in the West Coast. And in the main, the Celtic nations gravitated towards the West Coast of most of the countries that they're part of. So I think the purpose of the festival is that we have a lot of shared challenges, we have a lot of shared identity, and we are all talking not just about home-produced content in the nations, but also about Indigenous languages in the nations. And I think the precious thing about this festival is that mostly our content is ignored. But in a situation like this, there is an awards, big awards ceremonies go on every day where content is recognised, which is really important. But also issues that are of relevance and that everybody's grappling with are discussed from a position of knowledge and experience and shared experience. And we all like to party, and my goodness, do we party.
We do party. That aside at the Minty, you mentioned there the word relevance. Now, we're from your side in Gaelic, from my side in Scots, we're still always struggling with this word relevance, to make the content relevant. From your side, how do you do that?
Well, I think that our biggest challenge at the moment is, like everybody else, is how are we relevant to young people? Because we have a lot of interest from Gaelic, for young people in Gaelic medium schools. They grow up to be young adults. You know, there's a lot of people in their 20s and 30s and 40s, early 40s now, who are Gaelic medium educated. And like Dee Forbes said earlier, you know, that what is happening to television viewing is that it's falling off a precipice for the under 45s. So how do we make it relevant? I have a theory that says older people like me, who've been speaking Gaelic all their lives, we are very likely to watch new content if it comes along, or find a means of contacting with the youth. Youth aren't quite as dedicated to watching what their elders want to watch. So I think that our big debates at the moment are very much about how do we make content for young people, and not just how do we make it, then where do we put it? What platforms does it sit on? But the other added problem that we have is that broadband is still not very good in parts of peripheral rural Scotland. So if we do put it on BBC iPlayer, or even on Facebook sometimes, or on whatever digital platform, it's not all that easily accessible. So there are myriad challenges, but there is no doubt, I think, that the future is very much going to be on demand. You still have to have your mainstream channels, I believe, but the future is getting very much to on demand.
Now, brings us to the challenges. The challenge, you've got a wide remit that's set in statute, a wide remit to deliver Gaelic programmes. Can you see that changing?
Well, I think as long as we've got a remit, you know, Gaelic is like Scots and every other language. You either speak it or you don't. You use it or you don't. It's as simple as that. It's not a commodity. It can be a commodity in the sense that people can access the music, people can access programmes with subtitles, all of that kind of thing. But ultimately, our purpose is to deliver high-quality Gaelic programmes. I can't imagine that can ever change. What might change is where they're delivered and how they're delivered, but actually the ultimate core of our mission will not change.
Well, this is far, as a Scots speaker, I would like to get your advice on something. You were at the stage where we are at one point, trying to develop, we're both trying to keep our languages alive in one way or another. What advice would you give to us sitting across at this side of the fence, you sitting on MG Alba, which is the business head of the BBC Alba? What advice would you give to us?
Well, the first bit of advice is never give up. There's a great saying in Gaelic which says, the Gael stops to take his breath at the top when they get to the summit. And I think that it's Anna Legea Lemoloch, you know, a Gael stops at the summit. And I think that what you know when you're working in Indigenous languages is that you're always pushing a boulder uphill. You're always pushing a boulder uphill. It's very hard to get traction. Everybody pats you on the back and says you're doing a great job. But actually,
but it never gets
they don't, you know, it's not fair to say that they don't care. But it's not material in the sense that doesn't win or lose votes for people. It's not going to get a public service broadcaster a slap on the wrist if they don't, you know, if they're not seen to do it as well as you want them to do it. So it is about never giving up, persuading, and also often the content starts to speak for itself. And I think for you, that's the most, you know, keep making the content, keep putting it out there, and keep bringing it to the notice of the people who have the coffers, you know, whether that's Creative Scotland, Scottish Government, local authorities, all of these people.
Now, on that word persuading, you can for I'm going to go over this. Is there any way we can persuade MG Alba to think about persuading BBC Alba to include more Scots in BBC Alba?
I don't see why not, why we shouldn't be having these conversations. I mean, I'm open to that. I don't see why we shouldn't be having these conversations.
Maggie Cunningham, chair of MG Alba. Encouraging words there for more Scots on BBC Alba. But fit about radio? Well, we'll talk a lot in a minty after we hear traditional Manx singer Ruth Keggan. This is for Ruth's new CD called Turris. This is Aran Suri.
Oh, shimmery, yow, yow, tummy, roo, a yow. Now, yow, the wack, the honey, gun, dead a boy in a crow. Machias and yes, we crook, as drunk at London. Oh, yea, and in Jeru, dead the buck and spin a quill.
Ruth Keegan, Manx singer, through the Isle of Man, and that's for our new CD called Turris. Now, reading the notes in the back of the CD, that CD was recorded in Scotland at the Watercolour Music Studio at Ardgour, Haymoor in Marianne Kennedy. And Marianne writes, Ruth Keegan is the pure and passionate Gaelic voice of the Manx musical renaissance. Richie and me like it and are.
Oh, it's fantastic.
We like that CD. It's a good voice, that.
Good job.
So back to the home of the Manx language and this year's Celtic Media Festival, for I was recently. The Isle of Man has its own Manx radio station. We are bilingual output, broadcasting in English and Manx. Anthony Pugh is the managing director of Manx Radio, and he told me how it works.
Our station is owned by the Treasury, so the Isle of Man government.
Isle of Man has its own parliament.
It has its own parliament, the longest continuous parliament in the world, over 1,000 years old. And our aim, obviously, is to be the public service broadcaster of the Isle of Man, reflecting what's happening on the island to the people here on the island. How do we operate? Well, we broadcast 24 hours a day. We have two networks. We have an FM channel and an AM channel.
No television.
No television at all. Obviously, we would like to do that, and our plans for the future is that we are going to visualise some of the broadcasting that we actually do. But I think that we won't transmit that in a normal way the television is transmitted. It'll be via the internet, because obviously it's a more cost-effective way of doing it. And people all carry mobile phones with them these days, and that's how they actually want to consume short snippets of video.
Which is what Scots Radio does as well, yeah. Short snippets.
And, I mean, I went to a conference not so long ago where the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation were talking about how they totally changed how they were spending their money. One, you know, if you're a broadcaster like the BBC, for example, we're doing radio, television, internet, and whatever else that happens to be around this week, then traditionally most money has been put into television. In Canada, their priority is now to put it into mobile, because everybody has a mobile device. That is how you will communicate, they believe, in the future, and they're spending more money on content for mobile than on television.
That's a huge step.
Oh, it's a major step.
A major
one. It's replicated to a smaller extent by what the BBC have done with BBC Three. Mm-hmm. That's become an internet-only channel. And I've heard the controller talk there as to how that's revolutionised how they do programming. I mean, one of the things I heard him say was that conventionally, if you're doing a television programme, you work in units of an hour. You know, it may be 58 minutes for a trail or a news bulletin or something. But that restriction doesn't any longer apply to them. If an independent producer comes to them with a really good idea, which is best done as 12 times 8 minutes or 3 times 12 minutes or whatever the combination is, they'll judge that on the merit of the idea, because they're not restricted by these, by the clock, which all television broadcasters have been in the past.
No. Back to the content from Manx Radio.
Yes.
You're broadcasting both in the Manx language and in English. How does that work?
Well, predominantly English. I mean, it's over 90% in English. I think you have to sort of cast your mind back about 60 years, to the 60s. The Manx language was really almost dying out. Fast forward to today, there are now about 1,800 speakers. Not all of them are fluent, mm-hmm. but there are about 1,800 people who identify themselves in a census as having some command of the Manx language. And I guess that is, there's a number of factors, but one is there is now a primary school, which is a Manx primary school, and everything is done through the Manx language. 3 or 4 years ago, there was one girl who had the first A-level in Manx. So, you know, it's obviously beginning to get there. Now, we are reflecting that. We have 2 one-hour programmes, which are solely in Manx.
Per day?
No, per week. There's one on a Monday, one on a Friday. And then we have another 2.5 to 3 hours. It depends on the time of year. Which are bilingual programs. And they go out on our main channel, and they're part of our main schedule. And as long as you speak one of the languages, that's English or Manx, you will understand what's happening on
that
program.
So with the bilingual programme, does somebody speak in Manx and does somebody else speak in the same conversation in English?
I mean, for example, one programme always has a Manx short story. So that will be read purely in Manx for 3 minutes. But prior to that, there may be a little indication of how the story's going and, you know, setting it up so that you've got some idea. And if you have a very small vocabulary, you'll probably pick up on some of those words. And then if we're talking, if there's been an interview, which is probably taking place in English, but may not have, but if it's taking place in English, then we don't go back and reiterate what's been said. We take the cue forward and try and take the audience with us, as opposed to having a sort of slow and pedantic style where you may say something in one language and repeat it in another. So it's a more dynamic programme because of that.
And the pleasure speaking to you. Say something in Welsh.
Say something in Welsh, my background. Very rather nice, siarad gyda chi. It's very nice speaking with you.
Anthony Pugh, Managing Director of Manx Radio. And a special thanks to the team for the Celtic Media Festival for their organisation and hospitality. And good nater, a' through the event, fit and ease. And we'll be broadcasting mair for the Celtic Media Festival in a later programme. But afore we leave Douglas and the Isle of Man and the Manx tradition, this is another track for local band Fionnuadhaire. This is, I'm going to try the Manx language this time, the tune titles, Fiddler Hi Chiarn and Craig Willie Sill. Was Fionnuadhaire.
Jings, oh.
Richie. That's Fergan.
That's Fergan, all right.
Like it.
I like
it. No, it comes as no surprise that you can hear similarities in the music for the Isle of Man and some of the music for Scotland. We share a lot of the different types of instruments throughout the Celtic lands. And in the world, that's far beyond the Celtic nations. We share the pipes. We, I think, accounted something like 30 different countries, Richie.
Oh, for goodness sake, is that right?
Mm-hmm. In Scotland, we are renowned for the Highland bagpipe, and mere attention is now being paid to the bellows pipes and the works of the Border Pipe Society in keeping that tradition alive. And most folk would associate the Smart Pipes with that part of the country. I didna, until noo. I had the pleasure recently of joining pipe maker Ian Kinnear at his workshop in Edsel and Angus, and hearing mair about the tradition. What a bonny, bonny sound that is, Ian.
Oh, thanks.
Right, a wee bit of the history of the pipes you've just played and fit their card, because there's different names for them if folk get confused.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I call them Scottish small pipes. They're all part of the bellows pipe family, of which we've got two or three different types in Scotland.
How long have you been making pipes?
23 years. It's coming on 24 years this year.
So, Fit, why do you go for the bellows pipes?
Just when I was younger, I'd learnt to play the Highland pipes, and then I was interested in instruments that I could play with other instruments, you know, and a set of pipes that I could play with fiddles and guitars and that type of thing. So, yeah.
Right. Give us a bit of the history of the bellows pipes.
Yeah, I mean, they've got a long history in Scotland, going back certainly 300-400 years, and I think at one time they were very widespread, and possibly more widespread and more common than what has become the more common Highland bagpipes now.
No, I associate the bellows pipes, the small pipes, the smart pipes as they call it, with the Borders area, but that's not just quite true, is it?
No, I think there's evidence of them having been played right throughout Scotland, certainly in the Highlands, and also very much in the northeast in this area.
Now, not that long ago, well, a few years ago anyway, I remember interviewing someone about the northeast music. Yeah. And they refer to this manny that played the Oxter pipes. Have you ever heard that?
No, it's not a phrase I've heard, but it's a good one.
It's an Oxter pipes.
Yeah,
and I thought, did I imagine that? But you're saying, no, you didn't imagine that, because that would have been the bellows pipes.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think they hung on in the northeast of Scotland maybe longer than they did in other areas, maybe even longer than in the Borders. So there's evidence of pipes, this type of pipes being played, bellows pipes being played into the early 20th century in this area. And from then on, they kind of died out totally throughout Scotland. They went for right up until about the 1980s, when people became interested in a type of bagpipe that they could play with other instruments. Mm-hmm. So they became interested in reviving them at that stage. But really, between the start of the 20th century and the mid-1980s, there was no bellows piping in Scotland.
But they were quite popular in this area.
They had been.
A big surprise.
I mean, certainly there's evidence of four or five makers in Aberdeen itself making, it would appear, purely bellows pipes, not the bagpipes as we think of as the Scottish pipes, but the Highland bagpipes.
No,
but
making. Have you done any research into this here?
Aye, a wee bit. And certainly there's, and there's been research done by other folk like Hugh Cheap. So there's quite a bit written on the Miller manuscript, and Robert Miller was a piper from Montrose, I think around about the 1830s, and he played what we think of as union or pastoral pipes, which are the forerunner to the Irish pipes. So in Montrose, mid-19th century, you've got a guy and his pipes exist, and his manuscript of the music he plays as it exists, and Hugh Cheap's done a lot of work on researching that. But to think that there was someone in Montrose playing basically Irish pipes at that time is fascinating.
What about this area, up near Edsel? Any evidence of it being here?
Yeah, there's a couple of sets I've got in the workshop here that came out of Glenesk from Tarfside. A guy up there, William Davidson, who I think would have been an age to play pipes between about 1850 and about 1900. He played his grandson, Angus, who's now in his 80s, brought me two sets of pipes, which his grandfather played, and he remembered his father telling him about how he played them with the bellows. But they've been in his attic ever since, and they're both bellows-blown pipes. They would have been bellows-blown. There's no bellows with them. One is, again, a set of pastoral pipes, the forerunner to the Irish pipes, and the other is a set of what we'd think of as Borders pipes or real pipes. neither of them are complete, but it's for me, it's great to know that...
It's a find, isn't it?
It's 15 miles up the glen from here.
Right.
100 years ago, there was a guy doing the same thing as I'm doing now, and yet there was this gap in between when none of that happened, you know. But to think in a remote, kind of remote place like Tarf Side that someone was playing mm-hmm. two different types of bellows pipes is quite amazing.
Quite amazing. Yeah. And what about the other side of the northeast, of course, famed for farm life and Fian markets? Any evidence of them being played at Wathies and places like that?
Yeah, I mean, there is oral testimony of a guy, I'm trying to remember his name, is it Francis Marcus or Francis Markey? Francis Marcus, I think, mm-hmm. playing at Fian markets up until about the 20s, I think, maybe, which is quite late for bellows pipes mm-hmm. in Scotland. So there were pockets maybe hanging on, you know, of or odd players hanging on in this area in the northeast.
So how far did your work take you?
Oh, I mean, I make pipes all send pipes all over the world. So the set last week went out to America, out to a guy in New York, throughout Europe, yeah, Australia, just doing a set for a guy, or just had an inquiry from South Africa. So all over the world, really. Yeah.
Is there a difference then between the music that was played here and the music that was played in the borders?
There may have been. There's certainly evidence. There was probably some common, a lot of common ground. But there are, again, there's evidence of manuscripts from the borders, like the William Dixon manuscript, which would be a more border style of playing, or more border, a different style of tunes as well. I presume in this area that they would have. There were more northeast type of tunes they would have played, but, but using the same type of instrument.
A subtle difference.
Yeah.
So, what's the next stage for you? How many pipes have you made this year already?
Well, I mean, in a year now, I make 25 to 30 sets in a year, so it's not a big scale business. But I'm also now developing an interest in doing a lot of work on the Irish pipes. So kind of quite, in a way, sparked by that, by the idea that they were in this area, or the forerunner to the Irish pipes,
kind of
developed a bit in this area. And as I say, for me, it's fascinating, that first of all, that they were played 15 miles up the road from here in one direction, and in Montrose in the other direction, and also that there were these makers. As a maker, I find it really interesting that just over 100 years ago, there were four or five guys doing the same thing in Aberdeen, you know, and you've got guys like James Sharp, John Naughton, Massey, William Mark are the kind of names of the makers that were in Aberdeen operating into the 1840s up to about 1850.
So were there distinctive pipers, like I've heard of the Aberdeen Highland Society, were there pipers dedicated to that society?
Well, actually, the guy I was referring to earlier on, Robert Miller, who was playing about the 1830s, mm-hmm. he was the piper to the Aberdeen Highland Society. And the pipes, which are a fine set of Union pipes, a really fine instrument. I think they're in the National Museum or maybe in the Piping Centre Museum now. They were gifted to him. He was obviously a talented player, and they were gifted to him by the Laird of Balogie.
Up in the side near Finnan?
Yeah. It's your neck of the woods.
So that was quite a find as well, isn't it?
Yeah.
Right. I think it's time to hear some more players.
Okay. Yeah.
Ian, it's a pleasure, and I'll leave you to do it.
I'll get strapped in.
Right, strapped in. Yeah. Ian Kinnear finishing that session with the tune Thunderhead. And this next tune is for the album specially produced by the Border Pipe Society, CAD Reclaimed. And this tune is by Gary West, that won the Society's music competition in 2013 to mark the Society's 30th anniversary. It's CAD the Jedburgh Bar Game. And the recording is preceded by the great Willie Scott, border shepherd and singer that I've heard money's a time. Willie's describing the bar game in 1986.
There's a bar like a cricket bar. I decorated it with ribbons. Somebody's got merit against this bar. And it's thrown in among the folk, and it's them to get hairless, and there's so many guns up the way and so many guns down. talking about that mission in the Doonies. And there's the water, you know, right in me here. In fact, it's the litter in me much. Now then somebody say, oh, that's loosed. I'll pull away to the pub and have a drink. And it's funny what's come to that bar. I'll come to the boys, anything. I've been in pull over. Ain't good and in the crowd. I'll come slithering into the water just. That's me good that.
Great tune. That was Gary West with the Jedburgh Bar Game. Now, I ken it's sometimes nae good kenning, but it is summer. Richie, summer.
I swear.
It's summer.
When?
Aye.
Now?
Aye.
When did that happen?
Well, just recently.
I'm still waiting on the snow coming.
Okay. Time for festivals, feasts, and floor shows, and of course, agricultural shows. The biggest of it in Scotland is the Healing Show at Ingleston outside Edinburgh. On this year, the 22nd to the 25th of June. As a wee preview to this year's event, I invite you to join me on this adventure as I bring in among the gentle giants last year. That was the Clydesdale Horses. Richie, you like the Clydesdale Horses?
Well, funny you mention the Clydesdales and the Healing Show. That puts me back to my childhood, and I've got a memory of being at Ingleston at the show with my Auntie Louise, and we seen a Clydesdale getting kind of ready for the show and stuff, you know, and it was kind of clipping and clopping about, and beautiful big horse. I'd never seen you in before. And my Auntie Louise just had these great big love hearts in her eyes, you know.
Aww.
And at that point, I didn't realise she used to work in the army with horses and with dogs. and that was her job. And she told me all about what she did in the army before she retired.
That would be a great event for
you. So she used to work with Clydesdales.
That's why you like the Clydesdales.
That's exactly why.
Right.
I've never forgotten.
We're doing Among the Horsemen and the Women, getting their horses and their kerties ready for the show in the big arena. And that's the first time I've come across the Clydesdale kerties. Mayor in Latin Aminty. First, I met up with Clydesdale Vice President Jim Rochid for telling me more about the Clydesdale horses.
It was a breed that was developed through necessity for farm work and road haulage, where we needed something a bit heavier and a bit more substantial to pull the loads. And the person that got the blame or the fame for it was the Duke of Hamilton. And that's why the name came from, you know, the Clydesdale. It was the valleys of the Clyde. Clyde Valley in Lanarkshire. It was Hamilton, obviously, was the home of the Duke of Hamilton.
So fun was this? Just about,
it was
a,
back in the 1700s.
And were they produced to do farm work specifically?
But initially, it was for farm work. Now, he introduced half a dozen Flemish carriage horses, carriage stallions. And he gave them freely, the use of them freely, to his tenants, farm tenants.
Right, so he bought
6 Flemish stallions, the carriage horses, to Lanarkshire. And he gave them freely to his tenants to use over what stock, what horses they had on the farm.
So it's a Flemish crossing?
They're originally a Flemish cross.
Right.
Now, they had all sizes and all shapes and all types of horses on the farm.
Right.
Even from wee Shetland ponies up to rough horses and various things, pulling carts, trying to plough with them. Now, the offspring was a superior animal to what they had in size and power. Now, that basic horse, they started to breed and improve them. And over the centuries...
That went right through Scotland?
It went right through Scotland and England and Ireland. And not only that, once we had gotten them to a size and quality to do the job for not just agriculture, but all haulage. If you think back in times before 1900, there was no motor power.
What about the Shire horse? Did that come into it?
That is a separate breed. Similar, very similar, but a separate breed.
A lot of folk... And I confused it with, didn't I?
Well, nowadays there's very little, to the uninitiated, there is very little difference. In fact, what we have done is crossed between them.
Ah.
Now, initially the Shire was bred for the guys in armour as a war horse. That started.
And was that an English horse?
That was an English horse, purely an English horse. But it was bred for a different idea. It was to take the knights in armour into battle.
It had to be a big horse to carry them.
That tended to be a bigger horse and a taller horse. But we in Scotland like to think that it took 3 shires to do the same work that 2 Clydes did. Because they were heavier, stockier. They were built more like bulldogs, if you like, closer to the ground, with more power. Where the Shire
was taller,
bigger,
heavier.
And to charge into battle, pulling power.
I love seeing is the dressed horse. You can. Where did the dressing of them come from?
The dressing became fashion. For instance, when they were youngsters. You left them alone, and when they got to a certain, like 3-year-old was when you started to break them for work.
May I afford that?
No, they had to get to a size, you know, like up until then they were still growing, they were still soft, they didn't have a lot of strength or power, and it was a bit unfair on them. It's like a child to do work that they weren't fit
for. So 4-year-old you started?
3-year-old.
3-year-old you started?
No. Now, they had this great big long tail that touched the ground. Which was dangerous to the extent that it would get caught in chains and machinery and stuff.
Oh, sorry.
So they would take most of it off.
So you bobbed the tail?
Actually, way back then, they docked the tail.
They docked
the tail? In Canada and America, where there's actually more horses at Clydesdales out there than there is in the whole of Europe.
Have been exported to Scotland?
All Clydesdales originated in Lanarkshire.
Oh. See, I didn't have any of this.
Well, you keep asking the questions and I'm silly enough to keep answering them.
Foot about. Join them in a wee while, right? Because we're going to go see some of the dress horses coming in.
Yes.
What are they going to be doing in the arena?
In the arena, there's, again, this was a new competition that's recently introduced to Scotland. But once upon a time, when there was obviously no motor power, the stallions, there were a man, that was his job in the breeding season, was walking a stallion from farm to farm in a certain area to cover any mares that were in season. Mm-hmm. Now, that was not so bad when the farms were close together. But when you're in Canada and America, Scotland's only a small postage stamp country compared with there. Mm-hmm. They developed a carriage that was similar to the carriage that you would put on behind a trotting horse.
Right, so they could...
They could put the baggage...
While they're about in comfort.
Yeah, they could sit rather than walk and take any luggage with them because they were away a lot longer and the distances between farms was that much bigger.
So this is a single carriage?
This is a single carriage.
I'd love to see that.
Well, it's got many names. It's got the ladies' cart, the stallion cart, the single cart, but it all does the same job. And it was originated for the stallionman's comfort and ride, but it's an easy way for somebody to get, or the easiest way to get somebody into driving horses.
Is that because they're so calm?
No, really, because that small cart can fit into a small vehicle.
Oh,
where tomorrow we'll have a competition and it'll be six horses pulling. Now, with six horses, you need at least six people, grooms. You need a wagon to haul that big that big dray, just like the Budweisers have.
Aye.
And it's just the effort, time and effort with it.
So is this why it's getting more popular?
It's getting very popular. It's actually the most popular, over in a very short period of time, is the most popular driven competition.
Wow.
And the girls, I was going to say ladies, but the girls can get dressed up in a nice dress and a fascinator or a hat, and the guys will put
hats.
On a suit.
I'm into hats.
Yeah, well, some of them like just fascinators. The guys will put on a suit and dress up, and it's like going to kirk on a Sunday morning.
I would love to see it. I'll join you to the ringside.
Yeah, we'll go to the ringside, yeah.
So, in about an hour's time?
Yeah, at 5 o'clock approximately. Half an hour's time.
Okay.
If we miss each other, we'll meet in front of the grandstand.
That'd be grand.
Yeah.
Jim Rockhead for the Clydesdale Horse Society. So Duana went to the stars, for the big horses were being sorted and put into the shafts of their wee kerties, called the ladies' kert or the stallion kert, as developed in Canada and the USA. I met in with Ian Craig, past president of the Clydesdale Horse Society. Look, how many horses are here just moving in?
In here, there maybe, in all, there maybe 100.
You see, it's incredible. Because I mind coming here a few years ago, and there wasn't as many as this. It's getting more popular.
It is, and the driving's a big thing now.
Right,
they've got six horse teams, and they've got four horse teams, three horse teams. There's a lot of driving horses here, aye.
But why do you think that started off so popular now?
Sorry?
Why has it become so popular now, do you think?
Well, just a lot of it maybe comes from the America. A lot of it's big out in America. And a lot of these people go over to America to the Toronto Winter Fair, and it maybe comes a bit from there too, but the likes of Hugh Ramsay and John McNall have driven here for, 20, 30, 40 years.
You see, this is a big part of our culture, isn't it?
It is. It is. There's no doubt it is.
Big part of our history, I suppose.
It is.
And if you think about what they did to develop agriculture in Scotland and how they helped it, they made it.
There's no doubt. And, I think they're on the... We've probably got 124 filly foals entered in about the same colts this year in the stud book. So they're getting more breeders into the game now. We're getting into a healthier state.
That's what you were saying, that there's more folk getting into the idea of breeding them and bringing them all into this.
And finding
this year 120 colts, 120 fillies, around about that.
Yes, that kind of figure. And we're trying to find new. We've got them, as I say, that the competition for Hoys, the Horse of the Year show. We're getting more people to ride them as hacks and event with them, dressage, just as many uses as we can find, just to keep the breed alive. We're still on the Rare Breed Survival Trust.
Are you?
Yes, very much so. We were in category one, which is most endangered. So we got down to about 15 stallions when the tractor came on the go.
Jesus.
Well, the war effort.
Of course.
And tractors and lorries come on the, you know, motor power come on the go. And it was only a few breeders that kept them alive. The other, they went to the glue factory, the meat factory, or they were just left out in the field till they died. And just a few, they were really, they were in category one, which is the most endangered category.
These beautiful
animals.
Yes,
almost lost.
Almost lost.
We're in category three now, and then you go up to category five, and then you can, they reckon you're safe after that.
Just in time, imagine losing our Clydesdales. Just doesn't bear thinking about. But no time to think about over much. Half a day up to the big arena, ginning up with Jim Rockhead again, to watch the horses and the Kertys coming through the tunnel into the ring for Judge John Anderson, looking resplendent in his suit and his bowler hat, was ready to put them through their paces. We were sitting next to Breanne Smith, from Ontario, Canada. Tell me what you do from in Ontario.
Basically what you guys do here, I show Clydesdales. We breed and show them. So we have the big wagons and we do the six horse hitch. And we also do the line classes.
So how many clients do we got?
Oh, about 40-something.
Yeah.
We had 7 foals just this year.
Wow.
Yeah.
So how big an acreage do you have out there?
Oh, my gosh. I'm not even sure. We have a big farm. Yeah. But we also have land in other places. Uh-huh. Let our horses graze.
So I've been asking for why Clydesdales. Fit, is it the boot Clydesdales that you like?
I love my Clydesdales. They're gentle giants, that's for sure.
Because I met your father earlier on when we were down seeing the carts and the horses being put into the shafts.
Yep.
So you don't take you haven't got any Clydesdales across here just now, though, have you?
Actually, the judge here today, John Anderson, he's a good friend of my father's.
Uh-huh.
He has a stallion that was bred over at my farm, and he won the Highland Show 3 years ago.
So we met John Anderson.
Yes.
His bowler hat. He looks really dapper in his body bowler hat.
Yeah.
He was just pre-selecting everybody.
Yes.
But it's really, I've been absolutely amazed about how popular this is becoming.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially over here. In Canada, we have Percherons and Belgians. It's not just Clydesdales. Mm-hmm. So it's really nice to come here and see just the Clydesdales.
Now, I'm going to ask you an awkward question. Mm-hmm. Are we still breeding the best ones in Scotland?
Maybe. Yeah. No comment. Ask my friend Jim over here what he thinks of that.
He didn't even tell me that he won something. What did you win?
I just won the two-year-old class. The two-year-old filly class, and it took many years to do so. It's a very difficult show to win.
Right.
Yeah.
Just we're coming. Okay, here they go.
Well, we've got about 27 horses here with single carts. The driver and the horses are in Sprendon as if they were ready to go out to Kirk on a Sunday.
Uh-huh.
The judge will put them through the paces where they'll have to be able to travel properly, make figure eights, and show themselves off to their best advantage.
I think that's just an amazing sight that we're looking at,
yeah.
Isn't it? I mean, how many did you say there was standing up over there?
There's 27 entered. The
27.
One has left the ring just now because of his misbehaving.
Oh, okay. Look at them, they're just standing really quiet. They came into this ring proud as punch, their heads held high.
Yes, they're happy to do the job. They wouldn't do it at all unless they were keen and happy to be there. And, well, it's like training a sheepdog or training anything else. If they're not happy in their work, they can't do it. No, they wouldn't do it.
I'm glad I eventually found you. I was raking out the show for you, thinking, he's here somewhere again. But I didn't realise, I was wanting to speak to you just about Clydesdales, but this is just open my eyes to if it's happening in the Clydesdale world. It's quite significant, isn't it?
Well, we're saving a breed.
And this is what's saving it, basically. And this the breed
is,
and
this,
the breed interest.
This is the culmination of a year's work.
Aye.
Years of work. These horses, there are not many of them used for showing in hand. They tend to be used for just for riding and driving. There will be a mixture in there of show horses as well. It's just another mixture, another job for the horse. It's another job and another reason to keep a Clydesdale. This one over in the corner, it's been put through, these two over, there'll be two or three there. I'll be going out at one time, and the judge will be watching how they're behaving, how they're pulling the cart, whether they're happy in their work, their stand, their pace, the speed that they go at.
All that as well.
It's a very difficult class to win when they've got the numbers that you've got, because there's a very fine difference between the first ones and the last ones.
I've seen my brother one. It's just phenomenal looking at this.
You were listening to them coming in through into the ring along the conch, through the tar. These were single horses. You imagine if they were pulling a dray with a team of six in front, they'd be come thundering through there.
I can only but thank you, Jennifer. Tell me about this. It was just an eye-opener to me, and what a discovery that this is happening. Fantastic.
Well, I'm glad to help, because it's part of our aim of the Clydesdale Horse Society is to promote and keep this breed alive. Well, I'm always glad to help.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Oh, fit a day that was. Thanks to Jim Rochhead and the Clydesdale Horse Society for their hospitality and their company. And before we leave the heavy horses, we have made a wee film of that day with the Curtis. And you can see the Clydesdales and their Curtis with the ladies and the gentlemen in their finery. That's on our webpage under Scots Radio TV, Clydesdale Horses. Link is there for Abdi to see, and it does your head good, Richie. You've seen it. You just
love absolutely. It. Bra wee film.
Just didn't hang about here, Luke.
Hiya, Luke. Hiya, Luke.
Aye. Richie.
Aye.
We're just about at the end of this edition.
Are we?
Thank you for joining us.
There you go, really. Aye. Lovely to have you on board, folks.
Aye. So on behalf of Richie and myself and Richie, it's been a busy programme. We're nae eens to hang about or to get carried away with ourselves. Well, we did get carried away. We just get over ourselves. We talk a tumble. Right. We've Tina Tumble a few times. Tina, of course, you know, our biggest fans.
Tina Tumble, she wrote in, didn't she?
Ah, she wrote in. Tina Tumble. Tina Tumble. So, you see, this is us getting carried away again. Far was we?
There's a wee tribute act for you there.
Was we saying Chiribai? Aye.
Was there saying Chiribai?
We were saying Chiribai. We'll leave you with this track for the new CD for Ross Ainsley and Ali Hutton. CD called Symbiosis, track called Gaelic. You see the journey up bit? Gaelic, journey up. Fitting track for this episode to finish with. Ross and Ali, of course, winners of this year's Best Duo Award in the Radio 2 Folk Awards. Fee! We're soon sorted, Richie Werner.
That's me.
That's you. And me, myself, Frieda Morrison.
That's you.
Bye now! Thank you.